Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 33 of Season 4 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a hilarious and poignant journey through the 1989 Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan rom-com When Harry Met Sally, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is not the same guest that I had the last few days. They unfortunately couldn't make it for the rest of this week, so I went and got one of my favorite guests to come back and join us for only 3 days this week, but you know, he's still great for 3 days. So welcome back to the show, Duncan Shields, who Hello. Is from the Time Bandits Minute, from Chronologically Speaking. He's also a burlesque performer, an animator, and most importantly, he's just a tourist here on Earth. So welcome back to the show, Duncan.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad you were able to find some time to join us this season.
It was wonderful to revisit this movie. I haven't seen it since it came out, so it was nice to come back.
Really? Wow. You haven't seen this movie in 33 years?
Yeah. You see clips of it here and there now and again, you know, in little best of moments or people referencing other things or riffs on it, you know, like I think some
riff. Why would someone want to riff this movie?
Oh, I mean homages, like other movies will have a fake orgasm in Katz's diner scene or something, and they're like, oh, that's a not so subtle nod to When Harry Met Sally or something
right.
like
okay.
that.
All right, that's fair. That is definitely fair. All right, so it's good that you got minute 33 because it's been 33 years since you've seen the movie. So that works out perfectly.
There you go. It's kismet. It's fate.
That's right. So minute 33 begins with Sally continuing to talk and ends with Sally trying to reassure herself. So the last 2 days and yesterday in particular, you know, Sally is telling her story as to, you know, what happened with her and Joe. She's telling Harry they finally, you know, they're sitting in the little cafe known as Amsterdam, you know, which we talked about yesterday a little bit. And, you know, she's just telling her little story about what made her come to a realization of why she doesn't want to continue being with Joe because the two of them just want something completely different in life.
Yeah.
Okay. And as she's talking, so she basically said, I'll read the dialogue and then we'll get into a little bit of a conversation about the dialogue afterwards. Yeah. You know, that's one of the things about this movie is there's so much dialogue. You can't just break it up. You got to talk about it straight through. And then after that, you can do it. So she continues by saying, and she looked out the window and she saw this man and this woman with these two little kids. And the man had one of the little kids on his shoulder. And she said, I spy a family. And I started to cry. You know, I just started crying. And I went home and I said, the thing is, Joe, we never do fly off to Rome on a moment's notice. And then Harry turns to her and goes, and the kitchen floor? Not once. It's this very cold, hard Mexican ceramic tile. Anyway, we talked about it for a long time, and I said, this is what I want. And he says, well, I don't. And I said, well, I guess it's over. And he left. And the thing is, I feel really fine. I am over him. I mean, I really am over him. And that was it for him. That was the most that he could give. And every time I think about, and then that's where the minute ends. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's a great, more or less monologue from her because it's telling us so much about her relationship with Joe, who, you know, I'm still shocked that she they stayed together for 5 years because based on what Harry was talking about a few weeks ago, you know, when they're on the airplane, it didn't sound as if Joe was really a guy who, you know, is going to stay in a relationship a long time.
No, but man, I sure love that fake out when Billy Crystal walks by and he's like, I think I know that person. And then walks, like, you know, right up to Meg Ryan and is like, Joe, is that you? Like, you're like, ah,
exactly.
Nice one. Well done.
They did that really well. Yes. I love the fact that they fake us out there, but also the fact that, you know, Harry does know Joe, you know, which is great. And he, you know, one of the things that I always have a problem with this movie is the fact that, you know, during the 5 years intervals between each of the various segments, you know, they on the one hand expect us that the characters should remember each other, but on the other hand, you know, they don't really. You know, like, how many people do you know that you would have seen in passing, you know, that you knew 10 years ago for one day? I mean, granted, it's an intense drive, But still, you know, 10 years ago you knew them, then you bump into them 5 years later. You know, how much are you really going to remember about them?
It depends on the change, and she changed quite a bit. But I do think that 8 hours in a car, or five
18,
hours in
18,
a car.
18,
was 18. It 18? Oh, 18.
Well, yeah, okay. In their world, it's an 18-hour trip from Chicago to New York. In ours, it's about 12. But okay.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a – yeah, well, I guess maybe they're counting the overnight or whatever. But did they crash overnight? No. Anyway.
No, they drove through the night. And well,
it's a long time.
Harry wanted them to stop, and that was one of the points of contention.
Right.
But they didn't stop.
It's a long time to be in a car with somebody, so I figure I might be able to recognize them again. But it might be that thing where maybe I'd be like, God, I know them from somewhere. Where do I know them from?
Exactly.
Right, which he sort of has. He has those kind of moments of like, yeah, it looks really familiar. And then on the plane, he's like, that's where I know her from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever. I mean, we all know a lot of people. We bump into people, you know, someone that you don't have contact with in 10 years.
Yeah.
The odds are you're not going to remember that much about it. Like I was, it's actually funny that I'm mentioning this. You know, last week, my wife and I went to a play. Okay, we saw a recent version of Fiddler on the Roof, okay? Yeah. And when we were waiting in line, I saw someone that I probably haven't seen in over 10 years. And I remembered his first name, and I could not remember for the life of me his last name, right? So I said to my wife, I said, I know that guy. And I told her his first name, and she's like, okay, who is he? And I was like, well, you know, we you know, both back when we were both single, you know, we knew each other, you know, around, like sort of like how I knew Joe. You know, we didn't live in the same Harry knew Joe. You know, we weren't living in the same building or anything like that. But I just found it really funny. So I ended up texting a friend of mine who knows both of us. And I said, what's his last name? And he told it to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. I should have known that. You know, that type of thing. So, you know, from that perspective, I guess you're right. It's something that you would say to yourself, I recognize this person, but I can't really place 100%.
Yeah, and it's a context thing too. Like I remember I was in Scotland and I bumped into someone I knew from Vancouver was standing in front of me in the movie lineup, right? And I was like, what is – this person looks so familiar, but it was like a friend from Canada and I'm in a movie lineup in Scotland. So my brain was like, I can't place this person, right? And then I was like, oh, it's a Canadian person. What are the odds that I'd be ending up in a movie lineup at Edinburgh next to somebody I know from Vancouver? Mm-hmm. But I had another moment in Vancouver where I saw this guy in the grocery store and he was like, hey, I know you. And I was like, yeah, I know you too. And he was a very unique looking guy. He wasn't like, I got one of those faces. You know, he was like 5'2", bright red hair, this giant bright red gnome beard, bald and big green bomber jacket on, pretty thick guy, like a really, you know, he's not a blending in type of guy. So like I'm like, I really recognize this person. And he was like, I really recognize you. You're this, you know, tall tree, this beard, you know. And we never figured it out.
Even to this day, you don't know who he was?
Even to this day, I've never seen him again. We talked for like 2 minutes there. We tried to go through places that we might know each other from. And he was like, no, I've never been there. I don't know that. And I'm like, oh, I thought that was the place. And he's like, well, have you been here? I'm like, that's not really my scene. And so we were both just like, this is so weird. You are so familiar to me. And I have no idea who you are. It's like there was an error in the Matrix or something and they forgot to do the complete memory wipe and there's still a shred left or something. I don't know, but it was.
Wow. As they say, it's a brother from another mother.
Yeah. It's a weird, it's a very strange experience.
Wow. That is strange. But
I really liked Meg Ryan's monologue here. I think she's really in the moment and, you know, she was talking a bit about how Joe and her never got married because they thought that spontaneity and the crazy sex, you know, just goes out the window when you're too tired, as her friends say. And I was wondering, because there was a lot of data on that in the McKinsey report, right? Mm-hmm. Like when the McKinsey report came out, that really blew a lot of people's minds on like, you know, what you were going through was actually really common.
Yeah.
right? Yeah. And I don't know what the over-under is on that sex after marriage thing, but it's always this myth that it goes out the window. And I don't know.
Well, if the myth was that it went out the window, then there wouldn't be children.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Maybe they're talking then just about the idea of frequency. But, you know.
Frequency, or I think with her, it seemed to be more like passionate spontaneity.
Right.
Exactly. You know, like, I think there's a rut that comes with marriage of like, it's Wednesday, it's date night. Do you got the energy, honey?
Right.
You know, like that's, which is like, you can still have a good frequency, but it's not, it's like in Cheers when I think it was Woody was together with his girlfriend, Kelly, there. And they were like, you know, what are you worried about? He's like, well, the frequency of our sex has really gone down. You know, we're just twice a week now. And Norm's like, twice a week? Well, you know, I guess you're young. You got to do it that often. You know, like it was this complete disconnect where like,
okay, but that's Norm. You know, come on.
when you're 19, it's every day. And then twice a week's like, what? You know, right. So I don't know. I see that's a, but I liked her. I really like her monologue here. And one thing I'd forgotten about Meg Ryan was just how blue her eyes are.
Yes, you really can see it. And this is one of those scenes where you see how blue her eyes are. It's amazing actually looking at that, you know, because they shine so much here.
Really, really do. The lights just, or the makeup's really popping them out. But she's kind of like the eyes. I found myself becoming really, really fascinated with Meg Ryan. Like they're like her magnetism to me is really odd.
Okay.
Like, you know, like when I get fascinated by the concept of beauty, like, because when you really look at somebody's face, the reason why they're beautiful stops being apparent.
Right.
You know, and you're like, oh, actually I can't pinpoint what's going on here. Why they're so magnetic. But her eyes are kind of like, you know, that actress, Meg Foster.
Yes.
Yeah. So she's got those like frightening husky eyes.
Maybe right? It's the name Meg.
maybe, but she's got these terrifying, blue eyes, and she was the first choice for Laverne in Laverne and Shirley, but the test audiences were like, no, she's creepy, you know. Her eyes are piercing blue, like really, really blue. She ended up doing a lot of like science fiction movies and fantasy movies and stuff, and I sort of was really, I love this monologue because it's just Meg Ryan talking, and I just see her as like, she's got all the components of a very attractive person, but she's not. She doesn't come across as an attractive person. She's kind of like almost like really magnetically bland.
Yeah. You know, and like I think that's part of the point here, that's what they want. You know,
It's perfect for that style. Like I know the French have a term of belle lad, which means beautiful ugly. So you'll see
I don't know if Meg Ryan would be considered beautiful ugly, but
no, okay. And that's exactly not what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. That's not her, you know, that's not Meg Ryan, but the concept of somebody who's like cheekbones are so extreme, you know, or their jaw is so extreme, or their you know, their ears are really weird or something, but there's something about it that sort of makes them really attractive.
Right.
Really magnetic. Something you want to be around and you want to talk to and spend time with. Whereas by all accounts, it should be, you know, a turnoff or something that repulses people. But for some magical reason, it doesn't.
Right.
But there's a similar magic happening. Yeah, thankfully. But there's a similar magic happening with Meg Ryan, I thought, because I was like, you've got the clear skin, the blue eyes, you know, you've got, you know, the height, you've got the figure, whatever, all of it's there. But it comes across as, again, super magnetic, but the magnetism to me is kind of mysterious. Like, I found, like, I could watch her, she could just be reading a menu here, and I'd be like, all in. You know, like she really commands your attention. And I also liked her. She's really natural, the way she keeps checking in with herself.
Right. She keeps touching her ear and moving her hair and stuff like that.
Kind of looking down into the left and looking off camera. Like, mm-hmm. is what I said true?
Right.
Yes. Yes, I think it is true. Like she's doing these little moments where it really seems like these aren't lines.
Right. I mean,
she's actually saying that
Right. I think I mentioned it earlier this week, but on the commentary, you know, there are two different commentaries that I have on my copy of this. One is just Rob Reiner, and the other one is Rob Reiner, Nora Ephron, and Billy Crystal. So on the commentary, Rob Reiner mentions how this is his favorite scene of hers in this movie, that she just does such a great job here. He says this is the scene he always comes to when he thinks of, you know, how great of a job she did in this movie.
I can see that for sure.
Which is great. I mean, it's great to hear that the director thinks that, you know, and on the other commentary, they had a whole conversation about the whole idea of sex on the floor. You know, I think Nora Ephron says that, if I remember correctly, I listened to it a few days ago, but I think Nora Ephron said that it was Rob Reiner contributed that to the, to the story itself. And then Rob says, but there's nothing like being in bed. Who needs to be on the floor?
Yeah. It's like people often discuss sex on the beach as being a really bad idea.
Right. He mentions that also. He says, who wants to, you know, be on the floor or have to deal with sand? You know,
the
type of things in movies, you know, it's just less practical, I guess you could say.
Or I think sex in the shower is another one that people talk about. Like, it's a great idea on paper,
right?
But then the actual physical logistics of it, and it's actually kind of awkward and strange.
Right.
Right. Oh, that was another thing about the movie. I totally forgotten that Harry Connick Jr. Was doing the
music.
The music. Like, mm-hmm. I know there's jazz standards in there as well. But hearing him riffing on It Had to Be You was like, oh yeah, of course that's Harry Connick.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
That's, you know,
we'll actually talk a little bit about that, I think, tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow that we get into that a little more.
That's right.
So, and basically one of the things that I find really funny is when she's giving her this talk and she's talking about the fact that she's with the little girl who she never mentions her name. She just says it's her friend's daughter, you know, Alice's daughter. And she says, you know, they see this man, woman with two little kids, you know, which is really funny because it's the idea that, you know, then they say, I spy a family, because it goes to the whole idea of, you know, the concept of a nuclear family, Do you remember what they would say an average nuclear family was at the time?
Yeah, I do. Everybody joked about it because it was a mom and a dad and 2.5 kids.
Right. Actually, it was 2.4. But yeah.
Oh, 2.4.
Fine. And apparently now they've updated that, and it's now a couple with 1.7 kids, but they've also 1.7. Had to change. They've had to change the whole idea of what a nuclear family is nowadays, you know, based on the changes in the way that society looks upon different structures of families.
Right? Sure.
So at the time, a nuclear family was, you know, a man, a woman, and then 2.4 kids. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know any other term for nuclear family?
Oh, gosh. What was the thing? It was all Reagan. It was family values. It was nuclear traditional values. Gosh, there was some kind of dog whistle term for the straight is normal and anything else is bad kind of thing. But I forget the term. Yeah, there was nuclear family.
There's nuclear family, elementary family, and a conjugal family.
Oh, a conjugal family.
Yeah.
That's a new one.
Yeah.
Okay, conjugal family.
Yeah, interesting.
That seems kind of literal.
Yeah, very much.
Right. And also the only other way I've ever heard that term used is prison. So it's not really flattering.
That's true. No, that's a conjugal visit.
Conjugal visits. This is my conjugal partner. You mean your wife?
Exactly. That's, I think, it'll be a little too in your face about it. You know?
Yeah.
But the whole thing. So, I mean, the whole idea is it's a family who lives together. You know, it's the people who are living in the same household, you know, as a family. So obviously that has changed. You know, that it's more acceptable nowadays than it was back then, you know, that you no longer have to deal with the quote unquote traditional family. You know, you have same sex families, you have single parent families, you know, it completely changes the whole idea. Blended families. Exactly. Well, no, I don't know if a blended family, because the question is whether a nuclear family is considered only biological or not? Yeah, you know, that's the thing.
Well, yeah. What do you do about like adoption, you know, or stuff like that? Like when you've adopted a child.
Correct.
I think a lot of people would be very offended to say, yeah, but you know, you're not like a family.
Right. No, you know, I've heard like, people say that to me. I have a blended family. You know, I had a son, my wife had two sons. And then when we got married, we had two daughters. So, you know, we have all three mixes, you know, just,
yeah,
you know, for, and there are people who say, well, you know, they're not really brothers and sisters, you know, but they are. Just a question of how you want to term it, you know, that type of thing.
Or like with like Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn, right? Like exactly. They got married. She had two or three kids from her previous marriage or something. And then he could raise them from like babies.
Wait, but now, did they get married? I thought they were just together. Weren't they?
Oh, I don't think one of those couples.
They were like, yeah, Susan Sarandon and what's his name? From Shawshank.
Tim Robbins.
Right.
Tim Robbins.
The two of them were together for like 20 something years, you know. Yeah, and they just never got officially, you know, married from that perspective.
Yeah, but Goldie Hawn's kids very much consider Kurt Russell their father.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so that's
so. What do you think? Okay, I mean the data that I have here is a little old, but okay. So in 1970, okay,
yeah.
What percentage of American households do you think were nuclear families, which you just have the original biological parents?
I go 65%.
No. So in 1970, it was 40.30%.
Oh, I thought it would be at least over half.
So did I. So did I. That's right. And in 2000, what do you think that number was? Do you think it went up or down?
I'm, you know, going to laughingly obviously say down, but maybe it's shockingly gone up.
No, it went down. It went down.
Okay. Okay.
It went down to 24%.
Yeah. Not surprised, right?
You know, because again,
I wonder when they're going to, like, because what do you call it? If there is nuclear families these days, they seem to be temporary arrangements.
Right. It's true.
With divorce rates being what they are, people, you know, they get these. Yeah, it's very strange. Like, my daughter is one of the only kids in her school whose parents are, like, still together.
Freak.
Yeah. A weirdo. But then, you know, me and my wife, we never got married either. So, you know,
right.
Now we're both okay with that. So,
right. So, I mean, basically the different categories that they have in this article is they talk about, you know, the nuclear family, the married without children so it's basically just a couple. So they aren't included in, you know, the 24% or the 40%. Because here they're just talking about, you know, families with kids.
Sure.
You know, and then you have single parents, same-sex. From this data, back in 2000, they weren't, checking that information either.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. So, yeah, no, it's just it's interesting the way things have evolved, you know, over the last 50 years from that perspective of the whole thing. But what Sally is describing here is this nuclear family. That's what she's looking at, and that's what she wanted. You know, that's what she wants.
Yeah, well, it's that dream, that little shop of horrors somewhere that's green kind of dream, right. You know? You know, you got a nice house with a yard.
Yeah.
You know, and you have two kids and a dog and a cat. The Simpsons, right? Like, The Simpsons is the cliche of that.
Right.
You know, that life. You know, some suburban house with two kids or well two and Maggie and
exactly. Yeah,
Ranger's little Santa's little helper and the cat. Does a cat in The Simpsons have a name? I forget.
I don't remember. I'm not as big of a fan of The Simpsons as I used to be. Years
not,
and years
yeah,
ago.
Not as up of my,
I remember when it first came out. I wouldn't miss it, but the years,
if I saw an episode I hadn't seen before, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I haven't seen this one.
Exactly. And now there are many seasons that I haven't seen.
Yeah.
You know, but I also like the fact that when she's describing this family and the way that the kids are on his shoulders, right? Yeah. The one of the kids is on his shoulders. She mimes it. You can see, you know, she's not just showing, you know, Harry this, she's also telling us with the whole thing. And as she's telling the story, she's getting like very emotional.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing that drives me nuts is that she's telling a lot of intimate details to this stranger.
Well, this is what kind of, this came up a lot throughout the entire film, was there's this almost like Woody Allen, New York. And I see it a lot with East Coast movies and New York movies, especially New York, where people are so cavalierly open about really intimate stuff.
Correct.
With relative strangers or with acquaintances.
Yes.
And I remember there was a movie, I forget what the movie was, but there was a small town girl who's visiting New York and she's visiting one of her friends that they're at a table and they're going around the table talking and all these other housewives having a white wine lunch. They're talking about how like the tumor has been, you know, gone away a little bit, or that, you know, really, you know, sort of intimate medical stuff, intimate sex life stuff. And she, and then it gets to like her turn and she's kind of like, I don't know any of you.
I've seen you know, that. Like, I've seen that. Wait, that was in Terms of Endearment.
Well, it might've been.
That was Terms of Endearment. Something. I just saw that 2 weeks ago again. Yeah. Yes, that she traveled from Texas to New York, and she was sitting there, and they were talking about it, and you know, and she was talking about her cancer. Yes, oh wow, that's really funny.
Yeah, it was an awkward moment, and I was like, that's the first time I've seen those two things in a film, right? Like I've seen a lot of films where people are private, and then I've seen a lot of these sort of East Coast films where they're just super open about really intimate stuff with relative strangers, and I think there's got to be. It's kind of soulless, you know, there's something kind of, I don't know, like in one way, it's super open and honest, you know, and in another way, it's not. I think it might fall into that New York people aren't nice, but they're kind.
Okay.
And then, you know, like, you know, whatever, Minnesota people aren't kind, but they're nice.
Right.
You know, or they'll say that like, you know, hippies are assholes pretending to be nice people, whereas punks are nice people pretending to be assholes. Okay. You know, like that kind of
very fair.
You get that thing of Minnesota nice, where they're very, very friendly,
right,
but who knows what they actually think.
Right.
But whereas in New York, everybody's up front, but it can be brusque and a little. But you get that all over. It's the same with Edinburgh and Glasgow. You get this kind of, you know, they say you'll have more fun at a Glasgow stabbing than you will at an Edinburgh wedding. You know, like you sit on the people at the bus stop, you know, the people next to you at the bus stop will strike up a conversation with you in Glasgow and you'll have a great talk. And that might be the last time you see them, you know, whereas in Edinburgh, it takes you like 10 years just to get two friends. You know, and they're good friends when you get them, but it's really hard to break in. So I don't know, right?
Interesting.
It's this easy
for sure.
To go intimacy.
Right. No, it drives me nuts the fact that she's sitting and talking to this guy she barely knows, who she's met twice in her life, even though she spent 18 hours, and she's talking to him about, you know, the dream of spontaneous sex life. That's not, you know, that's not a conversation that most people would have with people that they're close with.
No. And I see it happening in like so many movies set in New York where people are just, you know, just rattling off these intimate details about stuff. Like they're talking about what they had for lunch yesterday.
Exactly.
It's unsettling.
Yeah.
But okay. Well, I'm glad that came up.
And basically the way that the rest of this minute goes, you know, she's trying to console herself at the end that she made the right decision. You know, she talks about how, you know, how she knows what she wants. Joe knows what he wants. It's not the same thing. It's interesting that it took them so long to figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, the 5 years to be with someone that you don't know, that the two of you have complete opposite views on where you see yourselves going in the future is also a little strange.
Yeah.
But.
Well, there's also, I think, there's a myth. There's a myth that you tell yourself in a relationship. I mean, I'm kind of just coming up with stuff here, but I think you have a shared goal. You have a shared belief about why your union is good.
Mm-hmm.
You have a shared belief about what you're getting out of it is what you need and what you want. Mm-hmm. And that can sometimes be a lie that doesn't become clear
right.
for a long time. And I think the way she expressed it in this monologue was really good. It was the idea that they were better than married people.
Right.
Because they weren't married. And the reason why was because any day now they could fly off to Rome. Any day now they could have sex on the kitchen table. And those are just two examples.
Kitchen floor. It was like, kitchen floor.
Kitchen floor, yes. The what did I say?
Table. You said the table.
Oh, yeah, kitchen table.
But no difference, no difference. Apparently neither is comfortable. So, you know.
Apparently, yeah. But this idea that like the myth was never tested.
Right.
It was a Schrodinger's myth. They were telling themselves that, you know, that's why their relationship was really good. That's why they were superior. But now they're like, but then she has that moment of like, actually, we've never gone to Rome, you know, and we've never had sex on the kitchen floor. So what else have we never done? And the myth started to unravel.
Right.
And I could see that taking a long time, right? Because if it's never tested, it's never tested.
Right.
And it's just like once it gets tested or once you investigate it, then it can fall apart. And sometimes it's for the best. But and then this might have been for the best.
Well, anyone who's seen the movie knows it's for the best because, you know, otherwise Harry and Sally would never have gotten back together. So, yeah.
That's right.
Yes. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't.
Spoiler alert.
So you have anything else you want to say about this movie before I get into the script?
Some stuff, but it can be for another minute. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, there isn't that much that has changed here. The monologue that she did yesterday and today, you know, pretty much stays the same. The only difference here is in the movie, Harry says, "And the kitchen floor," and in the script, he goes, "What about the kitchen floor?" You know, but I think it flows much better the way that Billy Crystal delivers it here by saying,
"Oh yeah,
you know, and the kitchen floor." You know, it's like because he's adding a little humor to this whole situation of something that we're not even, you know, we shouldn't even be having this conversation, and we are, you know, that type of thing. So that's the only real difference here between the two, and it worked. Yeah. It works better this way for sure. Yeah. All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Harry Burns Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five Billy Crystal performances. So, Duncan, what have you got? Start with your number five and work your way up.
I guess my number five would be Throw Mama from the Train. Well, I have an honorable mention.
So go the honorable mention first. That's okay.
The honorable mention is when he hosted the Oscars.
Oh, okay.
one of the times that he hosted.
What do you mean, one of the times? Every one of those times. He was, in my opinion, he's one of the best Oscar MCs. There's no question about that.
Yeah. The one I remember is when he did a musical montage.
He does it every time. He did it every single time.
Oh, every time. Oh, okay. Yeah. Because I just remember him doing his The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
You know, like that, that whole bit. It's great. It's great.
Yeah, he's great. People.
How many times did he host?
I think 11.
Really? I thought it was like five or something. Wow.
I think so. Now you made me curious.
11 seems like a lot, but I wouldn't be surprised because he's kind of synonymous with Oscar host in my.
Well, because he did some memory. Great ones in the, you know, in the 90s and stuff like that. Sorry, nine times.
Nine times.
No, it was right between the two of us, so that's good.
That's got to be a record.
No, it's not. What's his name? Bob Hope did more. And I think Johnny Carson also did more.
Johnny Carson?
Bob Hope did it 19 times. Billy Crystal, 9. Okay. Johnny Carson only did 5. Wow. You're right. There you go.
19. Gosh, Bob Hope.
Eh? Yeah. Jack Lemmon did it 4 times. Whoopi Goldberg, 4 times.
Oh, that would have been 73. Jack Lemmon.
Jerry Lewis, 3 times. Cool. David Niven, 3 times. Steve Martin, 3 times.
David Niven? Yes. David Niven. Yeah.
But he didn't do it on his own. He did it together with other people. Okay. You know, he also has the you know, the famous appearance where you know, the streaker ran across behind him in 1974.
Oh, right. Streakers. No, streakers.
Yes.
Yeah, so then 5 is Throw Mama from the Train, and then 4 would be City Slickers. That was tremendous fun. Everybody else was the foil, right? You know, like, and he's just regular Billy Crystal, but like another fantastic Bruno Kirby performance that I think that Billy Crystal and Bruno Kirby really work well off of each other, even though Bruno Kirby's only in this movie for a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, they had a falling out right after City Slickers, which is why he wasn't back in for City Slickers 2 and stuff like that.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, because they were apparently best friends in real life also, which is what helps the dynamic. But they had some sort of falling out. No one knows what the falling out was.
That's a drag. Yeah. That's too bad. That's too bad when that happens anyway, but it's like, that's too bad. I loved it when he showed up in a movie, and that he was just as at home in Donnie Brasco as he was in, City Slickers, right? You know, that he could be funny and comedic without really changing gears. Sure. Like, you know, he was just that much of a good, I was sad to hear when he left us. So City Slickers, and of course the amazing Jack Palance and doing 200 push-ups at the Oscars. I remember that. And then number three would be Deconstructing Harry, when he was the devil. That he was so funny when he did that little bit as the devil. It's like, you know, you ever the blind girl? Oh, they're so grateful. And Woody Allen's like, oh, you're, that's awful. You know, like, it was just because he was the new boyfriend of Woody Allen's ex-girlfriend or something like that.
I haven't seen that movie in years. I should revisit it one of these days.
It's a montage that has a really good bit with Robin Williams in it too, where he goes, as an actor, he's out of focus. And they're like, oh, we got to change the lens on the camera. And they're like, no, it's not the camera. It's him. He's out of focus. And they've done this special effect where he's out of focus, right? And he's like, but he's treating it like I won't get roles anymore. I've lost whatever magic I had. I was gonna, you know, really be something. I gotta just focus. I gotta, you know, and then as his parent, you know, his whole family's like, it hurts to look at you. Like, I'm getting a headache looking at you. And it's just so bizarre, but it's really, really funny. But it's a good movie just because it's got a bunch of different short stories. It's almost like you got a collection of short stories and just somehow shoved them all into one movie.
Okay. I'll have to take a look at it.
It's good. And then Monsters, Inc. would be number two, because I love his chemistry with John Goodman there. And then number one, which I'm sure is many people's number one, is Princess Bride, with his, you know, have fun storming the castle. That's a MLT. He said, to blave, which we all know means to blow. Liar! You know, all that stuff. Absolutely incredible. I never saw Mr. Saturday Night, but I've always been curious.
It's a fun Saturday movie, but it gets a little too heavy along the way.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what comes down to. I think Billy Crystal directed it, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was his baby. It was
I'm a bigger fan of his directing 61, which was all about the home run race in 1961 between Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle. And Billy Crystal did that. It came out in 2001. It's one of my favorite baseball movies. It's just, you can see that Billy Crystal made that movie with so much love. You know, because he himself,
61.
Yeah, he himself, 61 star. You know, he himself was really good friends with Mickey Mantle. They met each other once on a Dinosaur talk show. And Billy Crystal knew that he was going to be on there with Mickey Mantle. And he brought like a program for Mickey Mantle to sign. And the two of them became friends over the years.
Wow. What a crossover of lives.
Yeah, seriously. You
know? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
All right, so Duncan, you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
You can just go to Tronologically Speaking and listen to that, or look for the Time Bandits Minute on all your basic things. I'm by Duncan Shields on Twitter and or we'll see for now on Twitter and Instagram and anywhere else.
Wait, you think you're going to get kicked off of Twitter soon? Is that what you're telling me?
Oh, I don't think I'm going to get kicked off. I just don't know how much longer Twitter's going to exist. But we'll see.
We'll see if it.
I'm sure it'll stick around.
I'm sure it'll still be around.
I'm sure it's some form or another. It's just
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can go directly to my website, movearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, I'll have what she's having.
I'll have what she's having.
Gave me a thrill with all your faults. I love you still, it had to be you. Wonderful you, had to be you.